back with you for a Friday afternoon. Susan, hey, happy school year. It's the circle of life, you know, the calendar clicks around, whatever it is, we're back here. Summer seemed like it happened, but maybe not so much. But here we are back for fall of 2022 here at Henry Ford College.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Alan, I am actually so excited to be back. I mean, some of us kind of never left, you know, we do work, but there is some very special thing about the energy, not only in and around the college campus, but even in those that are attending, you know, on Zoom and virtual and so on. There's just there's some eclectic energy in the air. I think it's one of my very favorite things being an educator is to feel that sense of we're excited, we're ready to go, we want to learn. So I eat it up. And I'm absolutely feeling it this fall term. So welcome back to you as well.
Indeed. And obviously, it's great to be back here on a Friday afternoon for the WHFR Journal. We've got a lot of things to talk about. Number one is, you know, some things coming up on campus. We've got and for those who want to look, they can go to hfcc.edu for events going on campus, including the Welcome Back Days coming up in a few weeks. And we can give you more details about that and things like that. But let's sort of jump into what we're going to talk about today. Education based. On today's WHFR Journal, what do we got?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, just received a press release not that long ago, and we have been, you know, we're certainly connected with and friends of like-minded organizations in the Dearborn community that are really meant to create awareness about positive opportunities and also educating people on how they can make things better, how they can accelerate impact on projects they're already working on and getting involved in things that they may not be yet. And I'll tell you, the Dearborn Education Foundation is one of those longstanding organizations in this Dearborn community that is just one of the jewels, really, that we are so proud of and excited to be connected with in this community and also to be talking about in today's discussion. So the nonprofit organization is over or just reaching its 30-year milestone. So that's a really wonderful thing to celebrate and an honor, 30 years of doing something good for the community. It does not come easily, and it does not come without support of wonderful people coming together to make a positive difference to our community. And that's exactly what we're doing today. So we typically have one guest on the journal. Today we've got two. And so we are welcoming and celebrating our two guests. And they happen to be the two new co-chair people of the Dearborn Education Foundation. So typically it is a co-chair situation with the foundation, and longtime past co-chairs, Susan DeBaja and Ali Sayed, names that we all know very well in our community. They are stepping down. They're staying on the board, working on some other things related to a connection with the Dearborn Public Schools. But we are now welcoming Hussein Mohammed Hachem and John Zadikian as the co-chairs, the leaders of the Dearborn Educational Foundation. So first of all, I think we should welcome and congratulate our two new co-chairs, and then maybe take a couple steps back for those that aren't as familiar with the Dearborn Education Foundation to fill in some of those blanks just a little bit. So, gentlemen, welcome. So excited to have you here today, and congratulations.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. I'm glad I'm here.
Sure. Who wants to kind of kick things off? Give us a little bit of a background. We'll talk about you and what you're bringing, what skills and experience you're bringing to this organization in this new role. But first, how about just a little background about this foundation and, you know, how it's impacting positively everyone at the Dearborn Public Schools?
Well, you have two media guys, so it's going to sound like four, actually, during this interview. But I'll let my beloved co-chair Hussein start us off.
Thank you, John. In terms of thank you again, Susan, Alan, for having us here. It's exciting times, to be honest, for you at the foundation. 30 years of giving back to Dearborn Public Schools, classrooms and teachers and students. And there's nothing better, especially in this age and time, than to support students and teachers and classrooms. Education is a key. This is something that preserves our future and make sure that we are a prosper community and a prosper nation. Dearborn Education Foundation, as I said, we've been, you know, giving back to Dearborn Public Schools since 1992. This year, we're going to celebrate, we've been celebrating our 30 years. We've given over $2 million in funds, scholarships, and grants to classrooms and teachers. If you ask me about me and my background, I wear multiple hats. One of them is I'm proud to be on the Dearborn City Charter Commission. I was elected in November. And I serve until 2024. Also, I am the CEO and founder of Educare Student Services. It's a after-school and learning center in Dearborn since 2013. And I'm also the founder and CEO of WhatsApp Media Network. It's a bilingual web TV that serves Arabs, Chaldean, and Middle Eastern and all over the U.S. John, I'll give it to you.
Thank you, my friend. And Susan, Ellen, again, thank you for having us. And it's a pleasure to be with you and be on WHFR again for me. It's been a few years, but always glad to be back. I am, like Hussein, I wear many hats as well. It would actually take less time if I told you what I didn't do. After a long career in broadcast journalism and corporate public relations, I hung out my own shingle back in 2009, and I own John Zadicki and Multimedia. And I do work similar to Hussein with audio, video, press releases. I'm the social media director for the city of Dearborn Heights. I've been doing that now for many years, and I enjoy it. It's my hometown. I love it. Also dabble a little bit still in non-commercial radio, just a little bit up the dial where they play some classical music and mix it in with some jazz. And I enjoy it, of course. I also have a number of other, you know, commercial clients in terms of my social media business and other things that I do. But I've been involved with the foundation for a number of years. I started out as a volunteer, actually hosting the Green Tie Dinner, which is our big spring fundraiser. And I think it was about probably 3 or 4 years in. And they said, you know what, why don't you join the board? And I'm like, sure, you know, I have plenty of time. I can do that for you. So it's been a great experience. I sincerely enjoy it. And Hussein and I really look forward to, you know, moving the foundation forward here beyond the 30-year mark. We've got a lot of great ideas, which hopefully we can get into. And it's one of those great organizations that I have no trouble giving my time or money to. It's just fabulous, and we both have it in our hearts and in our souls to make it continue to succeed.
Now, we've talked about grants and scholarships, and I'll send this one to Hussein. What are those grants and scholarships? What do they mean at the classroom level? What do they mean for the students and stuff like that? Just tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. Scholarships hits home for me because I'm the chairman of the scholarship committee. This is how I started with the Dearborn Education Foundation as someone that has a background in education. We started with just 3 scholarships. I'm proud to announce that we moved them up to 19, and it keeps increasing. It's just more money going into the pockets of students that really need them. Every dollar helps, and it makes a huge difference. When it comes to grants, usually the process is very simple. We try to make it easy for teachers to request money for projects that they want to do in their classrooms. And really, for this year, we set over $170,000 to give back to classrooms between restricted, general, and scholarship that are going to go back to Dearborn Public Schools classrooms. Grants, they range from supporting things related to, you know, books, robotics, projects, or building trades, sports, all kind of that good stuff, you know, musical instruments, microscopes, computers, anything that, you know, we can support the students with, we try to do so. When it comes to the scholarships, as I said, we're now up to 19 scholarships. Each scholarship has its own criteria, but usually it's very targeted, and usually we cover all of the high schools, and we have one scholarship that actually covers middle school too.
Now, my wife's an art teacher, so I'm well aware of, you know, needing supplies in the classroom and, and what grant funding can provide. I've been sent out late on a Tuesday evening to go buy another box of markers and things like that at times. So what for the teachers and for those, I'm assuming obviously they know about you and are able to, you know, to be able to apply for those resources. But how does that work from, you know, at the classroom level for your teachers?
In terms of how they can request it or how? Mm-hmm.
Correct. Yeah.
How they can request it. Basically, there is a simple application process. They fill out the application. We have a grant committee. Basically, the grant committee reviews those grant requests. They collaborate with Dearborn Public Schools because some of those requests, actually, they are honored by funds from Dearborn Public Schools. So if this is something that's not covered by those funds, then we look at it, we review it, and we see how we can help. You know, most of the times we want actually the teachers to do also their parts in terms of trying to fundraise some of the money so we can help them with the rest of it. Each month we receive, you know, requests that basically range from, I would say, sometimes from 15,000 to 50,000. And then depending on the funds that are available and the goal and the theme that we have for that year, we try to honor as much as possible, depending on the money that we have available on hand, whether it's going to come from the restricted fund or unrestricted fund based on the request. And once it's approved, basically, they know, we send them basically a notice, and then we write the checks to them.
You make it sound easy, and that's the way it needs to be in order to process work effectively. We all know that getting bogged down in all the red tape can sometimes make or break, you know, that ask or that request. So thank you for that. To remind our listeners on today's edition of the WHFR Journal, we are talking to the two new co-chairs of the Dearborn Education Fund, celebrating 30 years as a pillar of support to the Dearborn Public Schools in this community. John Zedekian and Hussein Hashem are joining us today. And both gentlemen bring a wealth and a variety of experience and expertise, and having some savvy working the media, working, you know, the channels to get information out, I think is probably a big coup and probably contributed to why you were potentially appointed as co-chairs. So there's certainly, you know, that side of things in this digital world we live in, the ability to connect with people both that are asking for help and that are wanting to help, I'm sure must make a big difference. So how do you incorporate getting the word out to the public to keep this fund, this foundation going? And how impactful is the use of your skill sets in doing that?
Well, social media, of course, is a big and important tool for all of the work that we do. The foundation, of course, has its own Facebook page. It has Twitter. It has Instagram. So we're on all of the major outlets, if you will, with regard to that, as well as our website. So there's a lot in the way of social media posts that we do quite frequently to let people know what we're up to, as well as what we're looking for with regard to currently, you know, we have our golf outing coming up at the end of September. We now have a Big Shot 50-50 raffle, where if we sell all 500 tickets at $100 a piece, your top prize if you win is $25,000. So that, of course, sells real easily when you put it out on social media to say, hey, look, you know, for $100, you can make 25 grand. So social media, again, there's quite a bit, you know, that we do there. We also have a third member on the board, Michael Kuntz, who is a Dearborn resident, who owns Visual Ronin Media. And we have been partnering with him since even before he joined the board to produce a number of videos, several of which have been placed on social media and YouTube here in this 30th anniversary year in particular, telling the story inside the classrooms, showing people you know, what they what their donations went for in terms of art supplies. We've done a lot, of course, over COVID with social and emotional learning types of purchases and donations. So there's that. And then, of course, there's also at the classroom level, we each of us are ambassadors for the different schools within the system. So it's up to us to go and make a connection with the principal, with the counselors, try to get to know the teachers as best we can to let them know that we are here, that we do have funds available for things that aren't necessarily, as Hussein put it, in the budget, you know, for that particular year. And we also have a payroll deduction program, which the district employees can make use of. And that's another way that we connect with them. So there are many ways that we go about it. The other thing, too, that we definitely take advantage of is our relationship with the school district. We enjoy great cooperation with the school district, as well as with the cities of Dearborn and Dearborn Heights. As many of you know, the River Oaks Elementary School is located within the city of Dearborn Heights. So there's that cooperation there with both the communities. And we are actually a model foundation across Michigan. Other foundations look to us for the great cooperation that we have between the foundation, the school districts, and the cities for not only working together, but also getting the word out about what we do.
Now, we mentioned something, and Hussein, if you had the details, a golf outing, and there was also a raffle and things like that, where our listeners can go to get some details about those events coming up. I'm not much of a golfer, I'll be honest with you, but, you know, it seems like a good cause. Where can we go to find out more about it?
Sure. As John mentioned, usually we're very active on social media and we have a very good website. So if you go to Facebook, for example, and you write Dearborn Education Foundation, we have all of the details about the event. Also, if you go to our website, which is dearbornedfoundation.org, under events, you'll see four golf outing, and then it has all of the details. And also it has a sponsorship form for those who are interested in sponsoring and supporting. And also it has a registration for those who are interested and basically taking part in that event. In terms of the Big Shot 50-50, every board member, we have about 23 board members now, John. So every board member has tickets and is selling tickets. I'm selling tickets, John is selling tickets. So feel free to reach out to any of the board members to basically get your tickets and a chance at winning up to $25,000.
Excellent. We know that when this foundation was founded, as read in your mission statement, it was designed to fund innovative programs and tools, ensuring that all Dearborn Public Schools students reach their potential. Mm-hmm. That says a lot.
It's a pretty lofty goal, isn't it?
Yeah. How much do you think that is actually happening? To what extent do you see opportunities to continue to grow that mission statement, to grow being successful in that? And what can we do to help?
We've developed a number of partnerships over the years with some large companies, you know, Ford Motor Company, you know, other large institutions that, you know, believe in the mission statement and have helped us out, you know, financially, as well as with a lot of individuals and smaller businesses. I mean, we obviously can't look those over either. I can say one thing, for as many times as I've been in the various schools delivering checks and going back and then seeing the look on not only the teachers' faces, but the kids' faces. We had a couple of years back before COVID delivered some musical instrument cases and things that they needed at Fortson High School. Those kids were thrilled. And they said, would you like to stay? We'll play a little jazz concert for you. I'm a jazz nut. It's like, get it. I'm there. So it was great. And of course, the little kids too, you know, when you go into the elementary schools and see some of the things, like I mentioned before, with the social emotional learning, some of the different things that we've had to, you know, sort of pivot and adapt to in terms of COVID. You know, and just dealing with, and you two are well aware of that, of course, here at the college level, mm-hmm. You know, how that has impacted operations. And it's been the same way, you know, all over. So the impact is there. The opportunities are definitely there to grow that impact. As media guys, Hussein and I plan to, you know, really ramp up the promotion and the media. He has a great audience, and I have a few friends that follow me on Facebook. So we do enjoy getting the word out, being a little bit creative, and just I think letting the general public know what we do. I think those who you know, maybe don't have children in the Dearborn Public Schools, maybe don't realize what we do and really how critical we are to keeping all the neighborhoods viable. Because, of course, as you know, you have good schools, you have good neighborhoods that go with it. So I think that's part of the mission for this coming year, is to let more and more people know that this is what we do and this is why we're doing it and how they can get involved with us.
So we're supporting the schools and the teachers and the students as well. There's also, as previously mentioned, scholarship opportunities and things like that. How does that work? How do students get identified? How do they apply? And, you know, what are some of those success stories that we've seen on the scholarship side of things?
Well, when you talk about scholarships, it's like, you know, music to me. Something pretty excited about. Like I mentioned before in the beginning of the show, we're up from 3 scholarships to 19 scholarships. Usually it's a application process, and the process is very easy. You go to our website. Also, it's dearbornedfoundation.org. Under scholarships, you basically find all of the scholarships that we have. Every scholarship have a description of it, what's the goal and the purpose of it, who can apply for it, what's required in terms of criteria, what kind of documents you need to basically submit. And then you can do all of that on our website, basically. So if you go, let's say, on the website, let's say, you know, I selected, you know, Dearborn, okay, let's see, one of them, a Bryant Scholarship, for example. You know, you click read more on it. You read the criteria, what kind of stuff we are requesting. For example, this scholarship is awarded to 2 students. Each amount is $500. You click on the scholarship application and basically you submit your application. It comes to us. We have a committee. I'm the chair of the scholarship committee. All of the submissions need to be submitted no later than March 31st. And basically we go over those submission. It's a rubric system, basically. So it's very objective. It's not subjective. It's based on points. Each committee member, they grade those scholarships, and then we add those grades and we come to the final total. And basically this is how we know who won it. And then we celebrate those students at our main event of the year, which is the Green Tie event.
And as we know, every little bit helps when you start to move on to that next level. Sure. And, you know, as we've seen, and, you know, Susan and I, we've had, you know, children who've been college aged and moved on and things like that. It's a very important part of the process as well.
When I used to go to Henry Ford and Henry Ford College in 2011, I remember the last year I did at Henry Ford was done for free because of those scholarships that I applied for. And it did help a lot because I had no financial support from anyone. My family is in Lebanon, and you know how economic hardship is in Lebanon. So I was by myself here working. So having those scholarship at hand, it really made it, you know, easier for me and to focus on my education and to continue my education, to be honest with you. It was a matter of, are you able to afford this to continue your education or not? And having those scholarships at hand really made it possible for me to finish my education and get a degree from Henry Ford, and then you basically transfer to Wayne State. So definitely it's very important.
Once a hawk, always a hawk.
Yes.
Go Hawks. There we go. Yeah.
I'm with you on that. Yeah. We are so excited again to be talking to you gentlemen, and you are really, you know, while you're starting in this new capacity as co-chairs, you certainly are experienced and seasoned members of this committee. And that is certainly something that's going to take you very far in this, stepping into this new role. One of the things I find most exciting, I read an article not that long ago, this time in 2022, the volunteer, you know, the mindset of volunteerism and contribution is actually greater right now than it was pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. So, and we are a generous nation, we are a generous community, but we're even more. And I won't go into the psychology of why that might be the case, but I certainly know that people have kind of done some checks and balances in their own life, in their own home, mm-hmm. since since this pandemic and sort of reassessing values and priorities. But one of the things that I find most endearing, and I mean that in the best way, about this organization, when I'm looking at your scholarships and I'm seeing the Stout Middle School Scholarship, the Pamela Adams Scholarship, you know, the MSBO Meridian Award of Excellence, this is local. I mean, it doesn't get much more local than those that are contributing to the success of our homegrown population, not only students, but also the educators themselves. And that is very special. And there's something very, I think, it's sort of an emotional intensity that is very moving about that. Mm-hmm. And being community oriented as much as this organization is, has got to just create a vibe or a feeling of something that's pretty unique and pretty special for those that are involved in any capacity with the Dearborn Education Foundation. How would you assess that from your perspective?
I can get into the psychology of it if you want, you know, as far as that's concerned, because if there's one good thing about COVID and the pandemic was that people came together more and more frequently because people needed help. We needed to get, you know, food to people. We needed to, you know, get supplies and this and that. And I think that's one great thing about the foundation, as well as a lot of other, you know, locally based organizations. I've been on the board of the Goodfellows for 35 years, and I'm only 36. you know, it's one of those things where, you know, the money is raised locally and it goes back locally. And I think that's important for people who donate, people who buy the 50-50, you know, big shot tickets, people who buy, you know, sponsorships in the golf outing, attend the Green Tie dinner, you know, make any other kind of, you know, donations to the foundation, and of course the parents of the kids of the scholarship winners and the students in the classrooms, they see that money going to work. So, you know, bless all the other organizations that are out there that are not necessarily based here. You know, you dial an 800 number, you give your money, you know, what have you, or you send a check in the mail and you kind of forget about it. But here with the Dearborn Education Foundation, it's so easy to see your money at work, because you're going to see it on your child's face when they come home from school, or you're going to see it when you go to that parent-teacher conference, or go to that band concert, or to that football game, or what have you. And I think that's one of the great things, you know, about the foundation that continues now in our 30th year.
And, you know, one thing to add to that, again, looking through the website and the information and so on, I wasn't thinking about the fact that the ability to honor those that have gone before us. Mm-hmm. I saw the I'm going to get emotional, the Robert Cipriano Scholarship. You know?
Yeah.
And wow. So some of these people have a legacy. We know those that have had the pleasure of knowing and working with so many of these wonderful people, but being able to see their names and connect good that they did in their lives, and to continue that level of good, that level of reaching out and helping others, it's quite special.
And Susan, I'm glad you said legacy, because we also have a legacy giving program with the foundation where, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith on Main Street or what have you can decide to leave whatever amount of money to the foundation when they are no longer of this earth. That is something that we have started in the last couple of years, and that is something that Hussein and I and anybody else on the board, Chastity Townsend, our executive director, you know, whomever, will be more than happy to talk to people about with regard to that. And it's a great way to leave your legacy, you know, going in this community by making a donation or setting up a fund or a different stipend to do that. And again, another great way to see your dollars at work.
Well, that legacy thing is a very important one, and we've even seen that in some of the debate over the last couple of days when we've talked about student loan forgiveness and stuff like that. You know, what is it that we want to leave and make possible to make things better for the future? And it's great to see that happening right here in our community. Once again, the website is DearbornEdFoundation.org. And Hussein and John, it's been great to have you here on the WHFR Journal today. Obviously, congratulations for both of you, or to both of you, for being a part of the organization. And we certainly hope to have you back and talk about some more of those success stories. One more time, either of you, Hussein or John, talking about that that golf outing before the snow falls. Let's make sure we have details about that.
John, go for it.
Go for it, Hussein.
They're so nice. They just want to give each other the privilege of being able to discuss.
You're the golfer out of the two. No, I'm kidding. It is our four golf outing, F-O-R-E, and it is happening on September 30th. And it is co-chaired by, of course, Superintendent Vallejo, as well as Mayor Hamoud. And the shotgun registration starts at 8, shotgun starts at 9, and it's happening at Taylor Meadows Golf Club, which is a beautiful course.
That's what my son tells me.
I'm not a golfer, and yet I'm golf outings all the time. I just don't get it. But it's a lot of fun. You know, we'll have breakfast, we'll have lunch, we'll have games, all the usual, you know, mirth and merriment. At the turn, Hussein and I do a little comedy dance routine. So that'll be, you know, that's the price of admission right there, you know, to do that. But it's a big fundraiser. We have a great time. The weather, knock on wood, has generally been nice. Whenever we've done it, then we purposely do it in the fall, obviously, to make sure that we're not sweating to death out on the course. But if anybody wants to play, purchase a foursome, to donate, what have you, dearbornedfoundation.org, dearbornedfoundation.org, I beg your pardon, that's the website, or just look again on our Facebook page.
Four golf outing, wonderful, on September 30th. I go for the food myself, I'll be honest with you.
It's a same here.
But yeah. Now I'm going for the comedy dance routine at the turn.
Great. Yeah.
That John announced. That was that's a scoop here on WHFR, because I know even Hussein didn't know that was happening until.
No, he didn't. He didn't.
You and I, Susan, on the practice putting green there before the course starts. So let's have a little putt off over there. So yeah. DearbornEdFoundation.org is the website for information about that and everything else. We're gonna wrap up this segment here and move on. We've got a little bit more coming up on today's WHFR Journal. Susan, it's again, you've never left. Welcome back for fall, but let's make this a great fall semester.
You got it, Alan. Thanks for everything, and we'll be back in a bit.
I'm Alan Mazurek. Along with Susan McGraw, we thank our guests Hussein Hashem and John Zadikian from the Dearborn Education Foundation on today's WHFR Journal. We'll be back with more in just a moment here on WHFR Making Waves.
Hey, this is the Gothicbilly Man, your friendly neighborhood beatnik, inviting you to join me for the Wrecking Hours, Psychobilly Surf Rock and Rockabilly radio program. Tune in every Monday, 6 to 8 p.m. on 89.3 FM in Detroit, WHFR.FM online. It's the station making waves, WHFR Dearborn.
Imagine battling cancer and actually beating it. You feel like you've just come out of the woods, only to discover you're about to go over another cliff. Hi, I'm Kathy Bates, and as a two-time cancer survivor, I can tell you nothing prepared me for the challenge of lymphedema, a chronic disease often brought on by cancer treatment that compromises the lymphatic system and leads to a lifetime of severe swelling and pain. Lymphedema, LE, affects more Americans each year than AIDS, Parkinson's, MS, muscular dystrophy, and ALS combined. Yet with proper treatment, it can be managed or even prevented. That's why I urge everyone facing a cancer diagnosis to be your own best advocate. Discuss LE with your doctor before undergoing surgery. With patients and doctors working together, we can learn and live. Learn more at lymphaticnetwork.org.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek with you until the top of the hour this Friday afternoon here on WHFR Making Waves. As exciting and invigorating as our previous interview was, we've got something else coming up next that I certainly hope that you'll pay particular attention to, and because it is also a fascinating subject and a very important and crucial one in our day and age. A couple of weeks ago on the program, we featured an episode from a series by Viral Networks, a podcast series that talks about a variety of concepts. And the one that we played a couple of weeks ago was how to detect a disinformation campaign. It's part of a series of podcasts produced by Michael Sugarman and Viral Networks. And today we have time to bring you actually a previous episode from this series. It was actually the first one in a series of six. And over time, we certainly hope to bring them all to you. And this one is entitled What Are Misinformation and Disinformation? And in this episode, Camille Francois talks to researchers, talks about how to identify misinformation and disinformation, and explains how platform design lets misinformation go viral, sometimes with deadly outcomes. A very fascinating and topical discussion. We do hope you enjoy it here on today's WHFR Journal.
Which is to say that when facts have yet to be established, or when facts are in controversy, that is what the wedge issue is that allows politicians, grifters, wannabe influencers to step in and say, you're being lied to.
You're listening to Viral Networks, a look at the current state of mis- and disinformation online with the scholars studying it from the front lines. We're your hosts, Emily Boardman and Dulaway. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Viral Networks, a podcast about mis- and disinformation.
Today, it can feel like any major social issue is exacerbated by mis- and disinformation. Elections, immigration, or COVID-19, just to name a few.
Yes, that's right. And often when we encounter deceptive memes or hashtags promoting conspiracy theories, it seems like that content is being shared organically. But as soon as you start separating fact from fiction, mysteries about this content begin to unfold.
Maybe you've heard of the term fake news thrown around by politicians and pundits. But mis- and disinformation goes a lot deeper than that. Around 2015, the field of disinformation studies coalesced to understand the origination and spread of disinformation in the digital space. Scholars of human-computer interaction, psychology, political science, and sociology came together to study mis- and disinformation from a number of angles, and the field has only grown from there.
Here on Viral Networks, we'll be taking a forensic approach to mis- and disinformation, talking to the researchers trying to solve the mystery of who is producing this material, how they're making it go viral, and why they do it.
If you want to learn about how this stuff gets made, how it moves around, and what we can do about it, you're in the right place. Across six episodes, all about half an hour long, we'll be talking with a wide range of researchers, ranging from public health experts to academics in the social sciences to doctors and folklorists. We conducted these interviews in the summer and fall of 2021.
So dis and misinformation are two different things, although of course they're related.
Without further ado, we turn to Camille Francois, who we invited on the show to help us understand in the biggest picture sense, what is mis- and disinformation? She has a talent for making the problem sound simple, but really we'll be spending the entire series unpacking the breakdown she gives us here.
We call misinformation the sharing of information that is false, but that people are sharing without an intent to deceive and without malice. And so, for instance, if I hear something about a vaccine that is actually false and I am spreading it to my loved ones because I am concerned about it and I want them to know. I am not trying to trick them. I am not trying to deceive them. I am simply sharing a false information because, you know, because maybe I believed in it. And so that's what we call misinformation. It's a big problem in, for instance, the medical field, right? Medical misinformation is the sharing of fake cures, you know, which again, people share without an intent to harm, but in case it might be true. Or of course, it's a big issue with anything related to vaccine safety. Now, disinformation is different from misinformation because of the intent of the person who's sharing it. And so we call disinformation information that is false, but that is shared with an intent to deceive, an intent to trick your audience.
We'd love to have a solid answer for why is this issue important? Why are we spending time? Why should sort of your average listener care about mis and disinformation?
It's important because it shapes our realities, right? I think that it used to be easier to argue that what happens online stays online. I think in 2021, that's a difficult argument to make. We know that what happens online shapes offline behaviors, right? We know that that separation is artificial. We know that whether or not people make important decisions about their health offline is informed by what they're reading on the internet. We know that when hate movements happen online, it can lead to offline insurrections. And I think that's one of the reasons why it really matters. It's because all of this really shapes our society.
In 2019, Camille developed one of her most valuable contributions to the field of disinformation studies. She calls it the Disinformation ABC. It's a really helpful framework for understanding the different ways a researcher can investigate and analyze disinformation. It helped us to structure our podcast too. A, B, C.
Okay, let's start with A, manipulative actors.
Sometimes you look at a piece of content on the internet and it doesn't look like it's been amplified by bots, or it doesn't look that, you know, like the content in itself is particularly deceptive. And you would wonder, like, why is this disinformation, right? And the reason why this is disinformation can be that it has been crafted by a sophisticated manipulative actor. And so this could be a campaign coming from Russian actor, Iranian actor, Chinese actor, and really any of the sophisticated actors who use disinformation for geopolitical goals. And if you look one degree of granularity sort of closer, you also realize that when we say Russian actors engaging in state-sponsored disinformation, there's actually a wide range of different types of Russian actors. Whether, for instance, it's coming from military intelligence is a very different type of campaign, the campaigns that are coming from troll farms like the Internet Research Agency. We've also seen corporate actors use this. Recently, my team worked on a campaign in which there were a series of pro-Huawei fake accounts who were commenting on Belgium regulatory proposals around 5G. And so when we see this, we also realize that corporate actors too have their own strategic objectives that they may or may not achieve using these types of methods, right?
Yes. Camille explained B stands for deceptive behaviors.
So this is about campaigns that don't have content that is necessarily deceptive and are not necessarily put together by manipulative actors. But the way they're spreading are using distortive behavior. So it could be, for instance, they're pushed by a bot army, or they're gaming a set of systems on the platform so that their impact, right, their impact is perceived to be much more than what they really have, right? It looks like this is a large-scale movement of people endorsing an idea when really it is just like just a set of parameters that have been well-tuned and a set of behaviors that have been employed to make it look like bigger than what it is or more impactful than what it is. That's, for instance, famously bots.
And finally, C is harmful content.
And it's interesting because today in 2021, we absolutely accept that there is a category of content that on its face constitutes disinformation and that the platform will take action for it. It wasn't the case a few years ago, and that sort of is the last category that the platforms engaged with. I think when disinformation became a key topic, they were more focused on manipulative actors, right? This is kind of where this big reckoning of Silicon Valley with disinformation came from in 2017 with the Russian investigation.
Here, Camille was referring to an investigation by the U.S. federal government into the possibility that Russia attempted to tamper with the 2016 presidential election through a range of techniques, including purchasing intentionally misleading political advertisements on social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter. But as she noted to us, some companies were attempting to take action against mis- and disinformation on their platforms prior to the fallout from the 2016 election, particularly around the burgeoning anti-vaccine movement that has been gaining steam on social media.
They had been specific platforms like Pinterest who had said, you know, there is a type of information about medical issues that if it is false and widely distributed, we will take action because we think it's disinformation and it shouldn't be there.
As you go through the model, it talks a lot about international actors and kind of foreign interference. It's mostly about geopolitics, right? But when it gets to the C piece, which is the one about content, the example that you use is the Pinterest that talks about medical or health information. My impression was like, yeah, it is obviously easier to tell what is acceptable or true when talking about health information than when it's about politics. Has COVID changed that?
I think it has changed that to the extent that a complicated, nuanced scientific conversation suddenly became very mainstream very quickly. And so the types of discussions, for instance, on different testing protocols for different vaccines, who used to be quite confined to, scientific communities online, are now absolutely mainstream. And the other major factor in making this relationship more complicated is the emergence and growth and consolidation of conspiratorial communities online, which have played a very significant role in amplifying, creating, distributing both mis- and disinformation on all these sensitive topics, ranging from COVID-19 to electoral integrity.
When we're researching, misinformation is just the biggest, broadest bucket. And it essentially means the sharing of false information or falsehoods. There's no communication without misinformation. Everybody makes speculative statements. I think I know. Somebody told me. A lot of people are saying.
Joe Donovan, the research director at the Harvard Sorensen Center, believes that spreading misinformation is something we do all the time and have been doing probably forever. Sometimes we just get things wrong. But what's fascinating about Joe's work is that it focuses on how political actors exploit this simple communication issue at huge scales and high speeds on the internet.
There has to be another criteria for us to count something as misinformation, which is it has to come from some kind of source where people are taking it relatively seriously. It's not just, you know, an individual. There has to be some other phenomenon. Either it's coming from an institution or a government body or a journalist, or it's coming from a lot of people at once. There's some kind of networked effect. What is driving that phenomenon? Who's behind it? And so for misinformation, we start to understand more about it as a phenomenon when we look at other criteria other than, is this statement true or false? When it comes to disinformation, though, we are very much looking at intention. It's a very high bar to call something disinformation. So disinformation is the intentional spreading of false information for some kind of political or financial end. And so most of the stuff we study falls into the bucket of financially incentivized misinformation or disinformation, grifts, scams, hoaxes, that kind of stuff. Part of the exciting aspect of the field is someone is trying to trick you, and your job is to figure out how. And so, are they hiding who they are? Are they hiding what their intention is? Are they hiding who is paying them? Are they, you know? And so, in some ways, the field itself develops out of the technology, because the technology isn't built for security and privacy. It's built for openness and scalability. And so it doesn't surprise me that you get these practices of media manipulation that require a subgenre of academic research to unpack and uncover. I view the field as something of a hybrid between cybersecurity and media studies in a very strange way, which is to say that, of course, people have always tried to hoax journalists, and this is, you know, they wouldn't call it PR if that wasn't also a heist, right? They would just call it what it is, which is media manipulation, right?
Joan told us she considers another factor in addition to actors, behavior, and content. We could give it a D for design.
And at the beginning of the pandemic, it was a torrent of hoaxes, scams, and grifts utilizing search engine optimization to try to get people's identities, to try to get their credit card numbers. And we saw, you know, all kinds of fake insurance, all kinds of fake cures, all kinds of fake masks, and, you know, just lots of scam products flood our media ecosystem, especially flood Facebook in particular. And through it all, these companies haven't really been able to stem the tide of misinformation, because it's an artifact literally of the design of the systems itself, which is to say that I think the field now is starting to understand that we're not just dealing with actors' behavior and content, we're also dealing with the design of the systems themselves. And so you can't just say, all right, well, you know, Facebook, get rid of the scams on your system, without also ensuring that Facebook has a prevention strategy in place that won't allow this to keep happening. The repetitive problem with media manipulation, disinformation actors, is that they know that any breaking news event can be leveraged to introduce fake information or false information into the world. And it's actually really hard to start up a campaign from scratch and get people to pay attention to it. So we've seen over the last several years, extreme weather events, mass shootings. These become places in which people will introduce false news or fake information as a way to draw people into some other set of concerns, right? And so they'll use sock puppets, they'll use bots. And a lot of times what they're trying to do is just give people enough information where they'll click like and follow. And it's preceding the field so that when they do want to launch a political campaign, they're able to. And so we saw accounts, you know, in 2016 that were posting stuff about the Kardashians for a while, just trying to gain followers and get attention. And then when they needed to, switched into more politicized content. The system's designed so that thousands of individuals that don't live together, that don't communicate with one another, all see something online and are like, that's cool, like it, next thing.
What Joan is talking about here is kind of terrifying to think about. Social media helps people communicate with strangers so quickly and at such a large scale that any crisis can be exploited at the drop of a hat. You might find yourself asking, where did we go wrong? Is there any good that can come out of the system that lets information basically move around with so little friction?
As I think about what we know in this field, the things that I've focused on is that people do make decisions based upon real-time information. And nowhere did we see that more clearly during the pandemic. How do you get a society to start wearing masks? How do you get a society to stop going to work? How do you get it? You know, we've witnessed some amazing, huge, broad social changes that have come about because everybody had to be connected to the same information. And of course, that doesn't come with uniform, participation, and people still resist. But at the same time, things changed, and things changed in mass, and they changed really quickly, which is testament to the fact that the information ecosystem has immense value and immense purpose and immense power as a result. But the pandemic has also taught us that if you tell people at 8 p.m. on Fox News that hydroxychloroquine might solve their or might act as a prophylactic against COVID, that within seconds they'll be searching for hydroxychloroquine on Google, and within minutes they'll be clicking on things that they think are related searches in order to try to buy supplements. And then downstream of that, you'll see a shortage at the pharmacy on hydroxychloroquine. You'll also see people buying tonic water because it contains chloroquine, which is a related search. And then some people, at least two people, ate fish food. And one of them passed away because they thought one of the chemicals in it was going to prevent them from getting COVID. And so people do take action based upon information. And as a result, we have to be really clear about what kind of advice, especially medical advice, people are getting when they're searching for things like COVID cure or COVID, prevention.
But Joe did offer us some hope. There are ways to design social media to encourage community moderation of facts, which can foster a healthier discourse.
The way in which Reddit has dealt with coronavirus information has been really exemplary, in the sense that people, when they post things on Reddit, have to tag it and categorize it so that there's a little bit more context to it. There's moderation on the message boards so that things that are erroneous or problematic get removed fairly quickly. And there's just a different set of care given to keeping the information environment high quality.
Joan, I'd like to spend some time with you trying to untangle political misinformation, medical misinformation. What are the spaces where the phenomena and the dynamics at play are the same? What are some key differences? Some of the people we've spoken to have used a broad brush and sort of think that medical misinfo can be lumped in and studied the same, and others think it's completely a different beast. So I'm curious on your views and what you see as the overlap.
Completely different. And they're completely different because the rationale for why one can be true and one can be false is completely different. Everything in politics is, to some degree, up to discretion, whereas we have a scientific method that establishes facts. Facts are merely patterns that are reliable. But what is being leveraged with medical misinformation is, by and large, scientific uncertainty, which is to say that when facts have yet to be established or when facts are in controversy, that is what the wedge issue is that allows politicians, grifters, wannabe influencers to step in and say, you're being lied to. And this is really important that we understand that when millions of people are getting the wrong information in mass, they take action on it, and it can actually turn really deadly.
Joan just scratched the surface of the issues with mis and disinformation that we're facing as a global community during the COVID-19 pandemic.
That's right. In our next episode, we'll be diving into that exactly. How has our collective information disorder shaped the way we're responding to COVID?
Still to come on Viral Networks. and look at who actually creates disinformation content, talking with experts about psychological interventions to combat it, studying coordinated inauthentic behavior, and more. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you join us for the rest.
Viral Networks is a production of Media Ecosystems Analysis Group. We're your hosts, Emily Boardman and Dulaway.
And Fernando Bermejo.
All episodes are produced and edited by Mike Sugarman. Julia Holm joined us as a scriptwriter and provided additional research. Music on this show was composed by Neil and our producer, Mike. Funding to produce this series was provided by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And last but certainly not least, we want to give a big thank you to all of the experts who joined us for interviews on this show.
The Viral Networks podcast, produced by Michael Sugarman. What are misinformation and disinformation here on today's WHFR Journal? Truly a fascinating listen. There are a few more episodes in this particular series that we hope to get to in future weeks here on the WHFR Journal. And certainly a heads up to my students who will be taking TCM 261, the broadcast journalism class, this fall semester here at Henry Ford College. Yeah, that's going to be one of your homework assignments over the course of the first couple of weeks of the class. Just a little heads up to those of you who might be listening today. Anyway, this is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. That's all we've got time for this Friday afternoon from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, 89.3 FM, online at WHFR.FM, making waves. Have a great weekend.
The Palace Theater proudly presents that new violin virtuoso, Jack Benny, and special added attraction, that sensational new invention, the Magic Lantern.
Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad, the story of a man who moved with it.
I'm that man, Matt Dillon, United States Marshal. The first man they look for and the last they want to meet. It's a chancy job, and it makes a man watchful and a little lonely.
For a laugh or a thrill and a hit of classic smooth jazz, it's Radio Vault Special Edition, Tuesdays, 10 a.m. to 1 o'clock, here on WHFR 89.3, the station making waves in your mind.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.